Welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us. Seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking to mitigate reckless and destructive development, this program aims to increase your ecological intelligence, to encourage you to think globally, act locally, and to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. In 2013, Island Press launched the Urban Resilience Project with support from the Kresge Foundation and the JPP Foundation. The project is working to imagine and inspire the sustainable, equitable, resilient cities of the future. Island Press brings together thought leaders with a broad range of expertise to generate and cross-pollinate ideas. Resilience Matters is a compilation of short-form articles advancing a holistic, transformative approach to thinking and action on urban resilience in the era of climate change, grounded in a commitment to sustainability and equity. Laurie Mazur, welcome to Earth Matters, and I want to ask you, what prompted Island Press to initiate the Urban Resilience Project, and how did the book Resilience Matters come about?
Well, sure. It was a couple of things, really. First and foremost, there's climate change, which is an increasingly real and present danger in the cities where most of us now live. You just look at the headlines. You see more than 50 people lost their lives in last week's heat wave in Quebec. We see record-breaking storms like Hurricane Harvey that dumped 33 trillion gallons of water on Houston and its neighbors last year. And here in the American West, what used to be called fire season now goes on all year long. And we also saw that climate change is playing out in an increasingly unequal world, you know, where the gap between the haves and the have-nots is growing. And of course, it's the have-nots who suffer most from climate impacts, who have the highest rates of asthma, which is made worse by wildfire smoke, who have uninsured losses when a hurricane hits. So climate change and inequality are converging to become the central challenge of our time. And the good news is that lots of people are stepping up to that challenge, figuring out how to make our cities more sustainable and equitable and resilient. And our role with the Urban Resilience Project is to work with those folks who are out on the front lines and to help them tell their stories and inspire others. And we do that in a lot of ways. You know, for more than 30 years, Island Press has published books on critical environmental issues. But several years ago, we realized that people are getting their information from increasingly diverse sources, including podcasts and online outlets and social media and more. So we realized that we really need to provide information and inspiration in all of those channels. So that's what the Urban Resilience Project is about. We inform people about how we can meet the climate challenges of our time through a wide range of formats and outlets.
Now, you mentioned Island Press, obviously a major component behind the project, but also this project wouldn't have gone through without support from the Kresge Foundation and the JP Foundation.
JPP, yes.
Tell us about those a little
bit. Well, these are two private foundations in the U.S. That are really doing some pioneering work on climate resilience in communities across the United States. Kresge in particular is supporting a lot of community-based work on climate, which is, you know, in some ways all resilience is local. There's a lot of great work going on in communities around the U.S. and support is key, and I think both Kresge and JPB are really pioneers in supporting innovative work so that it can then be replicated in its own way in other communities. We had some funding from the Kresge Foundation to look into urban resilience and how people were thinking about it and working on it, and what we should do about it, and what, you know, sort of what the needs were in the field and how we might meet them. And so Bounce Forward was our answer to that. And then Kresge and also the JPB Foundation gave us, and by us I mean Island Press, grant funding to launch the Urban Resilience Project. And so the project generates all kinds of content, including, you know, short form articles, blogs, op-eds, and also books. And so Resilience Matters is an annual compilation that we do of all the kind of short form content that we've had published in various places.
Okay. And what's your position at Island Press?
I'm the urban resilience editor, and I'm the person who gets to do short form stuff with various authors, you know, most of whom are people who are sort of working on the front lines. You know, they're activists or they're practitioners or public officials, and they're often sort of too busy to write and tell their stories, so I make it easy for them to do so, and then we, you know, get that work published in various online and print outlets.
Okay, right. So I want to start off by asking the question, what do you mean and what does the organization mean by urban resilience, and what's the difference between that and, say, something like emergency disaster planning?
Yeah, I think there's plenty of overlap between the two. Both disaster planning and resilience are concerned with preventing and also recovering from disasters like flooding and fire. But resilience, at least as we define it, is also concerned with equity. It's about making sure that risks and rewards are shared equally so that all people have a chance to survive and thrive in a changing world. So that means we focus not only on coping with, say, sea level rise, but also with issues like affordable housing and job opportunities and access to health care.
Mm-hmm. And there are a number of different sections in Resilience Matters. And is it going to be an annual event, an annual publication?
Yes. Yes, and I should add that it's also available to download for free on our website at islandpress.org.
Mm-hmm. How have you broken up the project into different chapters, if I can call it that?
Well, it's broken up into sections like health and food and water, urban development, infrastructure, because these are all really components of urban resilience. And, you know, of course, you could write a book about each of these topics. And, you know, in fact, we do publish books on each of these topics. But I think the point here is that it's a huge interconnected problem that requires really holistic solutions. We really need to look at all of the systems that make up our cities, including food and water and energy. None of those on their own will make our cities resilient. We need to look at the whole picture.
What came first, the topics or the fact that the various different authors of these articles were writing articles and you compiled them together? Or were they given direction to write about certain topics?
A lot of these folks don't consider themselves authors. They're people who are, they're community organizers, or they are, you know, experts on some of the subject matter. And we're not telling them what to write about. We learn about their work and, you know, believe it's an important component of urban resilience. So we work with them to help them tell their story and then reach audiences who can put that to use.
And what are some of the outlets that they use? You say online and some are hard copy magazines. What are some of the outlets that we read these articles in?
Yeah, I mean, we do op-eds that run in, you know, print newspapers all over the country, all over the U.S. We also, you know, like say we are writing about a policy issue. For example, last year there was a move in Congress to get rid of the WaterSense program, which helps produce water-efficient appliances. And so we worked with a group that wanted to target policymakers with that information. And so we published an op-ed in The Hill, which is widely read by Congress members and their staff. And it ran online, but it was also read into the Congressional Record. So that's, you know, that's how we target the right audience.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to a bit more of the definition of urban resilience. Are we talking mitigation or adaptation?
Well, it really has to be both. You know, given the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we have to adapt. You know, there's a certain amount of climate change that's already in the pipeline, and that can't be changed. And, you know, our cities simply have to adapt. But at the same time, it's not enough to adapt. We also have to mitigate and prevent the worst impacts of climate change because, you know, the worst scenarios may simply be beyond our capacity to adapt. So that will require really an all-out effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
And have we not always had to think about our urban landscape as a resilient entity?
I think that, you know, cities have always had to be resilient. You know, many of the world's great cities have had to bounce back and rebuild after devastating fires or earthquakes or plagues. But what's different now is really the global scale and magnitude of the problem. I mean, climate change is contributing to so many different kinds of disasters, wildfires and flooding and heat waves and these monster storms. You know, so in countries as large and geographically diverse as the U.S. and Canada, you may have all of those things happening at once. You know, so in the U.S. in 2017, it was the most expensive year on record for disasters with, you know, something like more than $300 billion in damage. So you think of that happening year after year in country after country, and you get a sense of what we're up against.
And it seems that for cities to build into adaptation or mitigation, rather, that they've got to be thinking long term. They can't just be thinking about next year's budget or the next election cycle. How do cities do that? How do they look 20, 30 years down the road?
Yeah, and that's a problem. It's not something we're very good at as a species, I would say, although some cultures have been better at it than others. But especially when, you know, the political imperatives pull us in the other direction, you know, it's hard to get policymakers to think beyond the next election. But, you know, it can be done, and frankly, it has to be done if we are going to survive in this era.
Mm-hmm. And Resilience Matters highlights some of those successes. Milwaukee, for example, Miami is madly designing itself or redesigning itself to prepare for the onslaught of rising water. So there are certain examples in Resilience Matters. Again,
health and food and water is a section, urban development, energy, of course. And the different articles talk about some of the challenges, but they also talk about some of the successes. And you've written a number of the articles yourself. I want to talk maybe about a couple, such as New Urbanism Isn't Dead. What do you mean by that? What's New Urbanism?
Yes, and I also just, before we move on to that, I wanted to absolutely second what you said about the fact that there's a lot of great work underway. You mentioned Miami, and, you know, voters there recently approved like a $400 million bond to address sea level rise, you know, which is really kind of an existential threat to that city. There's other great work going on. We see cities banding together in, you know, regional collaboratives. That's happening in Southeast Florida and the San Francisco Bay Area and many other places. And, you know, there are networks of cities, including C40 and the 100 resilient cities that are enabling cities to sort of share ideas and learn from one another. So I just wanted to correct the perception that this is all doom and gloom. You know, there's a lot of really great work underway. So it's been our privilege to help lift that up. New urbanism, is a movement among architects and planners sort of centered on the Congress for New Urbanism. Their vision is of, you know, sort of compact, walkable, livable cities. The new urbanists have recently really embraced the challenge of adapting to climate change. There was an article that ran earlier this year saying that new urbanism is dead, basically because, you know, its tenets have been so widely accepted. But my article argued that, you know, it's not dead, and it's sort of freshly relevant in the era of climate change.
Mm-hmm. I also came across a term that I hadn't heard of before, urban diary. Charles Wolfe wrote an article about that, he wrote a book about it, about how average citizens can note what goes on in their local neighborhood, add that to a database for the city, the municipality, and the civic leaders really have eyes on the ground, boots on the ground that really looks at their local neighborhood, what's good, what's bad, what needs to be changed. That's an interesting concept, that the average citizen can make a difference, can influence what a city does. So how did that come about? Where did Charles come from, and what can you tell us about his book?
Yeah, that's a really great book and a really interesting model. Charles Wolfe, and the book is Seeing the Better City, which Island Press published last year. And, you know, it's sort of built on the premise that, you know, the best kind of city planning comes from the folks who actually live in the city and know, you know, what's important to them and what needs to be preserved and built on and what needs to be improved. And he tells a lot of great stories about how, you know, how new technology, you know, notably smartphones, enables people to, you know, collect data, visual and otherwise, that can be fed into the city planning process to make it more bottom-up rather than, you know, sort of top-down planners imposing a vision on the city from 30,000 feet above. So it's a great book. Check it out.
Okay. There's also a section on environmental justice. Black people are left out, by Charles Ellison, for example. Diversity is not enough is another article. Reflections on Houston and you know, what does the environmental justice organizing look like? So how does that play into resilience?
Yeah, well, this gets to the equity issue that I mentioned earlier, which is really key. The environmental justice movement rose up, you know, several decades ago to protest the fact that environmental hazards are really disproportionately located in low-income communities and communities of color. And the mainstream environmental movement was not really focused on that a few decades ago. That's changing, albeit slowly. And environmental justice leaders like Robert Bullard have done really great work to shine a light on that injustice. So today, leaders like Jackie Patterson of the NAACP are doing the same for climate justice, you know, showing that marginalized communities are disproportionately harmed by climate impacts. And, you know, because placing the burden on poor communities and communities of color is not a solution. You know, our cities are not going to be resilient until everyone is resilient.
There's also several articles with reference to President Trump with regard to changing in urban planning, climate change, healthcare, etc. If Trump wasn't president, would these articles ever be published?
You know, in this country, we went from an administration that was really taking a leadership role on climate adaptation to an administration that does not accept that climate change is happening. So, you know, naturally, that's a focus of our writing and thinking, but we certainly look forward to a time when we get to write about a more enlightened administration in this country.
So that's the 2017 version of Resilience Matters. Perhaps in future years, the narrative will change a little bit.
That is our fond hope.
The fact that most countries and in North America, we've already approached, you know, the 80% mark, the 80% of the population living in urban centers. Does this cause us to think more about urban resilience? Is this why one of the reasons why it's popping up as a huge item?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, since, as you note, the majority of people now live in urban areas, cities will really shape our collective future. I mean, right now we're adding about 1.5 million people to the world cities every week, you know, and it looks like that trend will continue for a while. So to accommodate those new city residents, we need to construct about 2.5 trillion square feet of buildings by 2060. And, you know, that's the equivalent of building an entire New York City every 34 days for the next 40 years. So we really need to get cities right. You know, if what we build is sustainable and equitable and resilient, we, you know, we have a fighting chance to cope with what's coming down the pike. And, you know, cities also, they present kind of unique challenges and advantages. You know, on one hand, they concentrate risks because most, you know, for example, most urban growth is happening along the coasts, which are vulnerable to rising seas and storms and, you know, put more people in harm's way. But at the same time, urban density and economies of scale can encourage more efficient use of resources. You know, for example, New York City has lower per capita carbon emissions than any other U.S. cities. And, you know, cities are really hubs of innovation. There's, you know, kind of a great synergy of bringing lots of different kinds of people together to solve problems.
In the book, the source articles have been previously published in hard copies like Houston Chronicle, the Tampa Bay Times, but also online entities like Quartz and Resilience.org. How come I don't see anything from Fox News on there?
Well, Fox News has not shown a great interest in this kind of content. But at the same time, you know, we do publish in plenty of mainstream outlets. You know, we've done pieces in USA Today and, as I said, in, you know, mainstream newspapers around the country. And, you know, it's certainly our intention to reach a very broad swath of North Americans. We don't want to simply preach to the choir.
Now, here's something I'm grappling with as I do more and more of these shows. Here's the question for you. Has the environmental movement too narrowly defined what success is, such as a total ban on bottled water, or full stop to killing whales, or a hard cap on the amount of carbon in our atmosphere? Are we restricting ourselves by having these hard and fast thresholds and insisting that we stick to them?
Yeah, what a good question. You know, it's really a tough one because, you know, the challenges are huge. You know, I mean, right now there is a debate where I live between those who are proponents of 100% renewable energy and those who would settle for 50, you know. And the fact is, if we're going to preserve a habitable planet, you know, we need to go to 100% renewable energy. But that doesn't mean that we consider anything less than that a failure. You know, I mean, that's just simply demoralizing, for one thing. You know, it's all a process. It's a, you know, and I think we have to celebrate all the victories along the way while still keeping our eyes on the prize.
A follow-up question would be, how can we build resilient cities when insurance companies and federal levels of government insist that we continue to build on floodplains and exactly the same manner as before? I mean, it's crazy to go down into Texas and see houses that have been flooded simply rebuilt but on higher stilts, using the same techniques, the same building materials that failed us once before. It seems that we're forced to repeat our mistakes.
Yeah, we're kind of slow learners as a species, I think. And, you know, you're right that the general practice has usually been to just build it back like it was, and that practice, you know, at least in this country, was reinforced by federal policy. But I do think that's changing, you know, though, again, too slowly. You know, you have cities like Tulsa, Oklahoma, where, you know, after repeated flooding, the city finally said enough, and they bought up the houses in the floodplain and made it into a public park. And I think, you know, we're going to be seeing more of this, just driven by sheer financial practicality. You know, I mean, the fact is every dollar we invest in disaster resilience save something like $4 in future disaster costs. So I think that eventually those in power will wise up to that, and hopefully before it's too late.
Final question. What lies ahead for both Island Press, the Urban Resilience Project? What do you see happening in the next couple of years?
Well, we're going to keep doing what we're doing, which is lifting up amazing stories of people who are taking on the, you know, the central challenge of our time, climate change and equity. And the great news is that we're busier than ever doing that. When we started this project, a lot of what we're writing about was sort of theoretical. But now we have more real stories on the ground of people who are doing great things. And we will keep telling those stories.
All right. Laurie from Island Press, thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters.
Thank you so much, Lawson.
Okay.